From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling talks to Dr. Michael Cassio from the University of Pittsburgh on non-voltage gated ion channels as CNS therapeutic targets.
Dr. Michael Cassio is an assistant professor in the Department of Molecular Genetics and Biochemistry at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Cassio received his Ph.D. in molecular biophysics and biochemistry from Columbia University in 1988. He joined the department in 1994 after conducting postdoctoral research at Scripps Research Institute and Yale University. The major interest of his laboratory is correlating the structure and function for membrane protein receptors and channels, primarily neuroreceptors. Dr. Cassio, what are non-voltage gated ion channels?
Well, there's a large variety of non-voltage gated channels, one class of which is the ligand gated ion channels, but there's also you also have your stretch activated channels, and you have temperature sensitive channels like the transient potential receptors that sense heat and cold, and also flavors that you would think of being hot or cold, like the vanilloid receptors, a wabine or a caspasin receptors that for hot peppers. But the class that we examine in our lab, and the one that I feel most comfortable talking to you about, is the ligand gated ion channels. And of those, there's a few different varieties. There's what's called the cis loop receptors, or the nicotinicoid receptor superfamily, and those are. And so just to go through all the different types, there's ATP-gated channels, there's the glutamate receptors, and there's the cis-loop receptors. And I'm going to be talking about the ionotropic receptors, or the ones that they bind a ligand, and then the channel is gated, so you get an open pore. And it's a central pore that's surrounded by subunits. And through that central pore, ions, either cations or anions, and sometimes it's selective, but those ions could flow down their gradient, and so it's a passive diffusion of the ions through a central pore.
Now, I think you anticipated my second question: how do they work? Is there anything you want to add to that?
Well, yes. I mean, what at a molecular level, no one really understands how they work. We are able to study them because we could do things like whole cell patch clamps or single channel recordings, and we can look at the response. And typically, you'll get no response until you add ligand, and then once we add ligand, there's a very fast opening, and for a lot of these channels, then there's a long-lived desensitized state. And so no one really understands the mechanisms where the signal's transduced. We know that you bind ligand, and in some way that energy of ligand binding is translated to an opening of a gate. You can think of it sort of just a gate that is in the middle that blocks the pore from the flow of ions. And then once that pore is open, the ions can flow down their gradient.
What are the major differences between voltage-gated and non-voltage-gated ion channels?
Well, the voltage-gated channels are gated by voltage. It's in the term, in what we call them, in that it's a change in the potential across the membrane, because the membrane or the lipid bilayer forms a natural barrier that, you know, separates inside from outside, say, of a cell, if we're talking about the plasma membrane. And across that membrane, there's a potential because the cell separates or pumps ions outside or inside, so you get different gradients of those ions. And so typically what we have is say in a nerve cell, it's electronegative inside, so it's hyperpolarized in that there's a lot more cations on the outside than there is on the inside. And that gives rise to a potential which can be used to do work. And that's the voltage across the membrane. And that voltage can open a channel. So for voltage gated ion channels, there's a voltage sensor. Typically, that's thought of as being some charges on part of the molecule that respond, that align with the field in some way. And when they move in this field, they can open the channel. So those are the voltage-gated. The ligand-gated ion channels typically are non-responsive, or in some cases there is some response to voltage, but you don't get channel opening in response to changes in voltage. What is required for the channel to open is the binding of a ligand. And those ligands are the neurotransmitters. They're also involved in neurotransmission of signals, say, between excitable cells, nerve to nerve or nerve to muscle. That signal transduction from one presynaptic neuron to a postsynaptic neuron involves both ligand-gated ion channels and voltage-gated ion channels. The ligand-gated ion channels, what happens is on the presynaptic side, when you get a fusion of the neurotransmitter-filled vesicles, spill their contents into the synapse, that chemical, the neurotransmitter, diffuses across this very small space, the synapse, and binds to the ligand-gated ion channel, binds to its cognate target. When that channel then opens, in the case of, say, if we're going to talk about cis-loop receptors in that example, you get, for acetylcholine receptors and for serotonin receptors, and so that if the binding of acetylcholine to its receptor or the binding of serotonin to its receptor opens a cationic channel. Cations flow into the cell because it's a more electronegative inside, and it's a general cation, so there's a lot of positive charge outside. So those ions move inside the cell, and that is a transient depolarization. That transient depolarization, in turn, opens voltage-gated channels. Now the voltage-gated channels open, and then you get an action potential. You get the propagation of the signal. So it's the working of both those together. In the case of the glycine receptor and the GABA receptor, those are the two other major classes of the cis-loop receptors, in addition to the acetylcholine and the serotonin receptors. In the case of glycine and GABA receptors, those open anion channels. And in adults in the brain, there is very low chloride inside and high chloride outside. And so the chloride goes in, even though it's more electronegative inside, the driving potential is such that chloride will enter the cell. And that acts to further hyperpolarize the cell, and you're less likely to have an action potential. So we call those receptors inhibitory neurotransmitter-gated receptors. Now, it all depends on the chloride potential. In some cases, say, in an inflammatory pain model, it turns out that you get chloride efflux, and they could be excitatory. But typically, the chloride channels, they're anion channels. We call them chloride channels because the main anion that goes through the channel is chloride. The chloride channels are typically thought to be inhibitory.
I've read that non-voltage-gated ion channels hold a lot of promise for the development of new therapeutics for central nervous system diseases. Why is that the case?
All neuroreceptors have potential for drug targets. And there are a lot of drugs that we know that work on the ligand-gated ion channels. For example, one of the most common drugs that is prescribed, Valium, it's a benzodiazepine, and it binds to GABA receptors. So it binds to a ligand-gated ion channel, and that's how it exerts its anti-anxiolytic effect. And it's also sometimes used as an anti-epileptic because dysfunction of the GABA receptors in some cases leads to epilepsies. Phenobarbital also targets GABA receptors, and that's used a lot of times in the prescription of people with epilepsy as a preventative drug. Other drugs that are very common, nicotine binds the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor and is an agonist for that receptor. And so in low quantities, it's a stimulant. It's also toxic at high levels, so it was originally used as an insecticide. Another common drug is ethanol. Ethanol works as a volatile anesthetic, and it affects many, many ion channels, both voltage-gated and neurotransmitter-gated channels and ligand-gated channels. It's known that for the GABA receptor and the glycine receptor, the binding of ethanol, when we think we know exactly where the binding pocket is, the binding of ethanol potentiates those receptors, so it makes them more active. And since they're inhibitory, it depresses the activity, the neural activity in those regions. And so part of that, the effects of alcohol are thought to be by their effects on ligand-gated ion channels. So the non-voltage-gated channels are rich targets for development of drugs. A lot of channelopathies, which are diseases that rise from dysfunction of ion channels, some of those, such as neuromuscular disorders, are associated with dysfunction of the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor or the acetylcholine receptors. Epilepsies or startle diseases, epilepsies, some of them have been shown to arise due to point mutations in GABA receptors, and some startle disorders are point mutations that alter the function of glycine receptors. So these receptors give rise to mood disorders. The GABA receptor binds barbiturates and depressants. So antidepressants can also be targeted to these receptors. So there are rich targets. Serotonin receptors, the subtype, the cis-loop receptors, some antagonists to serotonin receptors suppress nausea and vomiting, and they are prescribed for people who are in chemotherapy.
Would you talk about some recent advances in non-voltage gated ion channel research with CNS indications? And I'm thinking specifically of things like pain, cognition, and even Alzheimer's disease.
The easiest one for me to discuss as far as my familiarity is with pain, because if you block the transmission between nerves, you can block the pain signal. And so one avenue that we are exploring in our lab is the use of targeted expression of glycine receptors in sensory nerves as a way to block pain. It's known that GABA receptors are very much involved in pain response, and baclofen, which is a drug diagnosed for spasticity, has also been used in some, has the potential for it in pain research has been explored. The problem is the side effects, is that your GABA receptors are widely distributed throughout your central nervous system. Glycine receptors are a lot like, they're part of the, when I say things are part of the same superfamily, meaning they have homologous structure. Their structures are very similar other than the neurotransmitter that binds to them and specific drugs that may interact with different subunits. One thing I didn't mention earlier is that the ligand gate ion channels, the nicotinicoid superfamily, is they're pentamers, and typically they're pentamers of multiple gene products, meaning there can be alpha subunits, beta subunits, and you have different distributions of different gene products in different tissues at different times during development. So some drugs may interact only with a specific subtype of the receptor. And the glycine receptor has a limited distribution. It's mostly in the spinal cord and lower brain. So if you could deliver that receptor to a nerve that does not have any glycine receptors, you can potentially target that by adding glycine, which is a typical neurotransmitter, but will not have any role in other nerves around those nerves except where you've delivered the glycine receptor. So you could potentially shut off those nerves. That type of approach has also been pioneered by Henry Lester out at Caltech. He has done some work where they have used an insect channel that's a member of this superfamily. It's an ivermectin-sensitive chloride channel. And they are trying to use that as a tool to deliver that and then use ivermectin, which doesn't have a toxic effect in mammals, use that to shut off nerves in response, say, to shut off pain. Because pain is a tremendous problem in society, in the quality of life. And if we could somehow control pain, we could potentially alleviate a lot of suffering. And so those are used in pain research. There's also large use of opioids because you have opioid receptors that may crosstalk with other receptors. So there's a lot of receptor crosstalk also where affecting one channel also affects other channels, and you can have responses that you would not anticipate. And so if we're looking at cognition and looking at Alzheimer's disease is a little bit less understood, but say cognition, it's known that learning and memory is, a lot of that is based on long-term potentiation, long-term depression, which is controlling the numbers of glutamate receptors at the synapse. and controlling the phosphorylation state, because these receptors are also modified post-translationally by other proteins in the nerve that modulate their activity. And so the glutamate receptors are a target for learning and memory. And it's known that in Alzheimer's disease, there's a rundown in your NMDA receptors, which is a subtype of the glutamate receptors, because there's different classes of glutamate receptors. So the glutamate receptors are another ligand-gated ion channel superfamily. Those, instead of being pentameric, are tetrameric. And of the subtypes, the NMDA receptor is very important. It's been implicated in oxidative stress because it also, in addition to other cations, it allows calcium to go into the cell. And calcium's effects are tremendous. Those receptors are targeted. And also there have been implications for, as you can imagine, if those receptors are important in memory and cognition, its dysfunction of those are thought to be important in Alzheimer's disease. And so some of the same drugs might be used in Alzheimer's research. Alzheimer's is a little bit more complicated in that we know some risk factors for disease, and we know some mutations that if they're present, you're at a higher risk for disease, but we are still learning about the disease. It's still poorly understood. We're still at a very early level in our understanding of Alzheimer's disease.
My final question is going to be addressed at your research, some of which you've already talked about involving pain. What other projects are you and your lab working on that involves work on non-voltage-gated ion channels?
Primarily, I would consider myself a membrane biophysicist, and what we're trying to do is understand at a molecular level how these ion channels work, how binding of an agonist at a distinct site gives rise to a transient opening at a site very far away. These are allosteric machines, and we primarily work on the glycine receptor. The glycine receptor is gated by glycine, and it's inhibited by strychnine. And that's how it was the first ion channel that was purified from mammalian tissue on the basis of its very strong affinity to strychnine. And that's a competitive agonist because it binds at an overlapping site with glycine. Glycine and strychnine compete for similar binding pockets. But there are also non-competitive and uncompetitive antagonists that affect and modulate the activity of the channel and are the drugs we've been talking about, things like ethanol that interact with the receptor. We want to try and understand how, at a molecular level, how this channel works, because we can understand the architecture of one class of the whole of the ligand-gated ion channel, of the cis loops, a superfamily, then those common rules apply for all of them. And that's been shown by other groups, have shown that there's a common topology and a common architecture to every member in that superfamily. So if we learn specific molecular details about the glycine receptor, we'll be able to translate those and understand how all those receptors work. And a lot of this has been pioneered by other people in the field, such as Nigel Unwin used cryomicroscopy to show the structure at 4 angstrom resolution of the acetylcholine receptor in electric eel. Other groups have crystallized, so Tishia Sixma's group has crystallized a binding protein that binds acetylcholine. And it's a soluble protein that's secreted by glial cells in the brain. But that protein has the same architecture as the ligand binding domain of the acetylcholine receptor or the glycine receptor or the GABA receptor or the serotonin receptor. So we've learned a lot from everyone that works on these things. But we're trying to build up more details about how the channel works at molecular level. So some of the ways we're trying to do that is we are systematically introducing cysteine residues. And this technique was pioneered by Arthur Carlin's work. Arthur Carlin and his colleagues, that he started doing this at Columbia University with the acetylcholine receptor, where you put a single cysteine and then you can use the free thiol of a cysteine to do chemistry, and you can attach labels, and those labels can be used then to try and get information regarding the architecture. So we're putting spin labels on the receptor. We're putting fluorescent tags on the receptor. We're putting cross-linking elements on there so that we could try and understand, use those as sort of molecular calipers and start measuring distances, but measuring distances not just of these are not static molecules. As I said, they're allosteric machines. So they are in a resting state in the absence of ligand, and they are closed. And then when they first bind ligand, they very quickly open and then quickly desensitize, and they're desensitized for a while. So there are multiple states, and we don't understand the transition between those states, and we don't understand the structure of each of those states. And if we were to be able to understand them, we could design drugs or therapeutics that could interact with specific states and stabilize or destabilize that state. And that is how we think some of the anesthetics work, that they bind to the open state and stabilize the open state. And so we could design drugs to do those types of those activities if we understand at a molecular level the structure of the receptor. So we're working on that. The biggest drawback for a lot of this research is getting the receptor in large enough quantities to be able to do the biophysical characterizations. And so pioneering work with, say, the voltage-gated channels was Rod McKinnon's crystallization. For that, he won the Nobel Prize. He was able to do that because he expressed it in bacteria. Some of these proteins do not express in bacteria, so the biggest problem is just getting enough of the protein. So we're also trying to overexpress the NMDA receptor, which is a subtype of the glutamate receptors, so that we could try and understand them also. So that's some of the work going on in the lab. We are also, as I mentioned before, trying to use the glycine receptor both as a tool and a therapeutic in pain research to try and use it to control chloride potentials in cells and use that as anti-nociceptive tool in pain research, but also use it as a basic science tool to try and understand the role of the chloride potential and the role of altered chloride potentials in various forms of pain, in inflammatory pain models. There's a spinal nerve ligation model for pain. So there's various types of pain, each of which might have to have their own therapeutic. But at a basic level, we have limited understanding of sensory afferents, and we can use the receptor as a tool. And so we're doing some of that research in the lab also.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on anything discussed during this week's podcast, please go to www.genengnews.com/blog and give us your thoughts. You might also want to answer the following question. What other kinds of studies might be carried out based on research involving non-voltage gated ion channels? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.